Chairman and Governing Officials. My name is Mervin Chetty, Permanent Delegate, KZN.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is George Michalakis, Permanent Delegate from the Free State.
Moshomuntle lotlhe ke nna ga le reko manopole go tswa ko Kapa Bokone leko la komiti le ke a leboga.
Good morning, Jacques Julius, Gauteng Permanent Delegate.
Good morning, Deputy Chair. My name is Moses Titus Mhlanga from Mpumalanga, Permanent Delegate. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Tumisan Kimbi, Permanent Delegate from the Western Cape, Chairperson of the Justice and Security. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Permanent Members, and Jacob Kosana from the Department of Justice and Cultural Development.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Prince Maluleke. I'm an advisor to the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services.
Morning, Chair. My name is Dorrance Bassett. I'm from the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development.
I'm Vilma Lowe, also from the Department of Justice.
Morning, Chairperson and Honourable Members. My name is Dingaan Mangena from the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Patrick Handemark from Legal Aid South Africa.
Yes, thank you very much. On my left is the Conduct Advisor. On my right, Secretary, the Committee. Committee section. Thank you for saying so. And the other support staff down there. Honourable members, I think let's start with our minutes. Thank you very much. I won't be long. I think you received your minutes, ladies and gentlemen. The first minutes are for the 15th July 2014. Are you all on that? 15th of July 2014, page 1. Yes.
Okay, thank you. I just want to check, are we doing page by page because it's going to be cumbersome if we're making page by page. Since when we have received the minutes, can you allow us to zoom on 1 minute because of the, according to the program here in terms of things, adoption of minutes does not say and table them one by one. So to me, all of them are clustered. We can allow them to do that.
Thank you very much. Are we all in supporting that? Thank you. Okay, we said 15th of July, 2014, and then 16th of July, 2014.
No, Chair, I wanted to raise some issues on the 15th of July. So like I thought we are going to do everything.
Yes. Okay.
So my hand is up to engage in the minutes.
Okay.
If you allow me to.
Please.
Thank you. Chair, on the first set of the minutes of the 15th of July, page 4, 12.1.4.
Now the secretary will not, we must capture this. So let me wait for the secretary here.
let's put these minutes aside. Let's put the minutes aside and start with the presentation. Then we extend the time for these minutes. Because there are many. And you cannot adopt something that we didn't clarify. Please.
Chairperson, with all due respect, these minutes come from the 15th of July. We had a problem last time. They were corrected, and they are now before the committee. We cannot start with the next meeting if we don't have our minutes approved of the previous times. It's been 3 months that it's outstanding. I think we should deal with it and get it over with. If we don't deal with it before the presentation, then at least afterwards, but we should not leave this meeting without these minutes being approved. Thank you.
Yeah, Chair, I think we, the both of the speakers, the honorables, they are not actually disagree. But the actual fact they are saying we should be dealing with the minutes today. So our proposal is that because most of the issues are internal, let us allow the department to present whatever they want to present to us. Then afterwards, we then conclude with our minutes. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. You see now the challenge that we are confronted with. Is because of the program or the agenda in front of us. The absence of the adoption of the program, it makes us to be difficult to address this. Because of, I thought when the chairperson outlined the program, and there was no objection from the committee members saying, no, let us change the program around and move the minutes to the last item. Then to us, it gives an impression that we agreed with the outline program that is in front of us. To say number three is the next point on the agenda. We have dealt with apologies. Now we are on number three. Now on number three, we want to shift number three to be the last item, to be the first item. So we why are we doing this thing to us? We have agreed with regards. So I'm appealing you to chairperson. Earlier on, I raised my hand asking for how we should deal with the minutes. We said agreed, let us move with regards to how we are going to deal with the minutes. We agreed the last time we requested the minutes must be presented to us before the meeting. We have received the minutes before the meeting. So I'm appealing to you, Chair. Can we proceed according to the program that you have outlined to us when we started the meeting? Yes, you should do that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Zimanda, can you give up?
I don't know from just since you're giving a ruling, but I just want to know whether the ANC want to have a caucus. I just come back to that.
This is the ruling. Thank you. Honourable member?
Let me just say, my hand was up.
Okay, before that, welcome, Minister. Welcome, sir. Thank you very much. Okay, we can proceed.
Thank you, sir. I want us to save time with regards to the minutes. I was on page 4. Of the minutes, the first set of the minutes of the 15th of July under 12.1.4. The members noted, according to that, what is missing is with regards to OSP. So I'd like to insert that because we did engage about the OSP when the department raised the issue that we noted that the members of many of the problems related to the public service and administration requested the DC to forward its input to the COPTA, particularly with reference to OSD, should insect OSD, the chair. The next page, the next set of, towards the next set of the minutes of the 16th of July, page 1. I don't know why my name has been changed now. Can you please correct my name my surname on the machine? That surname is very important surname. The person who gives his statement has passed a legacy to me. And I'm hellishly catching the statement. And the next set of, the same set of minutes on page 5, Chen, with regards to OSD. And the last sentence which says this levels manage other levels. There is clearly does not give content of them because of this the minister must give reflection of the minister so that the person who was not present in the minister in the meeting be able to understand what is this. When he says if this level manages other levels, it needs to be put in the context because of the department raised the issue that the OSD is giving them cumbersome because of it affects them the how they classify the other levels and be able to put my other levels to another level. So can the secretary consult his notebook be able to rephrase this sentence before we adopt it and then leave towards the summary and then give us correct context of that. And it seems as if that's all. But okay. No, the in the same page 5. 13.14.1. Same set of minutes. It's just a spelling error. Department reported a positive response to the SCC already established. So, what that's my contribution. First saying that, thank you very much under your leadership and the secretariat. We had to our call. The last meeting, we requested the minutes must be corrected and also the way the minutes have been corrected. We agreed that upon to it, it should be summary based this minutes. So we'd like to say thank you and congratulations to the team there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. 23rd July 2014 and then 28th July 2014 minutes of the 30th July 2014 minutes of the 17th September 2014 and the last minutes of the 16th October 2014. Can we adopt the minutes?
In the absence of any hands, would the amendment that I forwarded therefore move for the adoption of the minutes? Thank you.
Second, Chair.
Oh yes. Thank you very much, honorable members and ladies and gentlemen. Minister, thank you very much to be with you today. You are welcome to this meeting, sir. Now, I think you come at the time that would like to hear from the Department of Justice to get briefing on progress made to resolve magistrate grievances. Together, we are there, and would like to hand over to the department to prefer the committee. Thank you. First, I think the minister maybe can have some words.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. My maiden visit to the Select Committee. I've had the privilege already to visit your house a few times. So it really gives me great pleasure to have this privilege. I think that I'm going to prefer to leave it to the officials to give a quick update on that, and if there's a need for me to clarify any issues on this one, I'll do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister.
Thank you, Minister, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. We are basically giving a status, a progress report on where the matters are pertaining to the status of magistrates. And just wanted to highlight that from the beginning that this is a matter that is currently receiving attention and is already a matter which this committee and the National Assembly will also be confronted with as well as that time of the year when the salary adjustments need to be considered from all the people who receive salary from the state also. Therefore, in the progress report, we basically outline what is the current legislative regime and remuneration that applies to magistrates with specific focus on pension and medical aid benefits, and then what is the request of the magistrates, in particular the Judicial Officers Association of South Africa, JOASA, on how those disputes can be changed. What is the process in involving ourselves and the magistracy? Why we are in the consultation? And what are the general views from a police perspective? And what recommendations and suggestions we wanted to give to this? And perhaps first, let's give the profile of the magistracy. We have the currently the establishment of magistrates comprises 2,026 magistrates who are divided in terms of the regional court magistrates and the district court magistrates. And of the 2,026 posts, we have 397 vacant posts, of which 311 have been advertised, and this should explain why some of the members of this committee who are members of the Magistrate Commission are required to or expected to spend some time filling those posts. So 311 still need to be filled, while the total vacancies are 397. The number of the vacancies basically were increased by the new posts which were created by the minister in 2013. A total of 113 posts were created, which basically increased those vacancies. Of the field posts, 60% are black and 40% are white. And we do have the stats in terms of the gender and also across the different categories of the black occupants of the post. But for purpose of this briefing, I think it's when the salaries. We can briefly state that the regional court president earned 1.1 million per annum. 1,115,314. Regional magistrate and 991.293 per annum, senior magistrate and 817,810. Magistrates are the lowest at 743,542. I have just given the comparison in terms of judges. I think the chief, we all know the chief justice salary 2.4 million, benchmarked against the death of the deputy president, and the judge president is at 1.8. And the ordinary judge is at 1.6. Now, the kind of scaling rates for the other judges of the SCA as well, but I gave this overall remuneration. And why I'm giving that is because
there's always been a demand from the magistracy that we have to attain some form of parity in terms of the authority of judges, and also there's probably been concern raised by the magistracy that the prosecutors at some level and more than magistrates. I'm going to give the example what leads to that kind of perception as we go along, but I thought I must just give an overview of what the picture is like. The standard of magistrates are regulated by law, and as public office bearers, they get the authorities determined by the RC, and the president determine those salaries based on the advice of the Independent Commission on the Revision of Office, Public Office Bearers. The current process is that the RC's term of office is nearing its end, and the process underway to resolve the RC. In the Civil Matter Code Act, the salary assessment text of Section 2.1 of the Act, and it provides a whole range of processes, one of which is that any determination by the President must be approved by Parliament. So this committee will soon receive the comments from the President, and those of, as well as those of judges. And the House, the National Assembly, and the NCOP must approve those salaries. Why is that so? Is because it is to protect the scheme of our constitution of ensuring the independence of the judiciary. The president alone and cannot determine the salary without involvement of parliament. And that does not happen in terms of the salaries of all other public office bearers, because they are in a different scheme compared to those of magistrates. And I'm also going to raise some points in terms of how this process has also created some challenges in respect of the magistrates and the judges specifically. Now, what have been the of major concern has been the fact that magistrates have always asked for their pension fund to be moved away from the government employee pension fund and be placed separately away from the other members of the public sector. Why they say so? Because they feel that is against the spirit of the independence of the judiciary. But the law as it stands currently clearly says that magistrates are part of the government employee pension fund, because historically magistrates have been public servants. And when they moved away from the public service, their pension funds, whatever, remained locked in the public, in the government pension, government employee pension fund. And there's express provision in the Act that provides for that. So if we want to change that, we need to come with a different Act. Magistrates have asked that they need the state to consider a different pension fund for them, because they are independent. Now, a different government have responded by saying that will be very expensive. We have 2,026 magistrates. To establish a pension fund to administer only 2,000 is not viable, because the cost of administering the fund will exceed the cost of the benefit derived from the process. The government employee pension fund administers the pension for all public employees. But it's very important to mention that the pension fund is not regulated by cabinet system. It's regulated by law. So when there's any change that must be brought to the pension fund, like the current rumor that goes that government intends taking money from the pension fund, whatever, that must be passed by Parliament. The minister cannot wait up tomorrow and say no minister will get a pension fund. Parliament must come and say this is how we change the pension fund. Now, to the extent that they are still members of the GPS, their pensions are in safe hands, because they are managed in terms of the law, and there's no way that they can change. And that satisfies the requirements of the independence of the judiciary. I wanted to state that upfront, that it does not necessarily mean that because they are in the different fund, administrative of the text, they are would be the lines of separation power are blurred. It doesn't necessarily relate to that. In terms of medical aid, magistrates have made a request that they will currently magistrate for the choice. They can belong to any eight medical aid of their choice. Discovery was an express, obviously, gems. And
they want to move away from there to form to be part of the parliament scheme, to which judges and members of parliament, to which judges belong there, etc. And again, for that to happen, the act that pertains to parliament must be changed to provide for that eventuality. But there are also processes that must be satisfied for that to happen. And I will allude to those processes to move on, etc. Firstly, parliament team is a compulsory team. It's not a choice team. Now, currently, we're making them for the choice. If I'm a member, my wife is a member of this cover, I'm a dependent, I'm covered. If I'm a husband, the wife is a member, she's covered, is covered. But if you change dispensation, it means my wife, who may happen to be a member, must be a member of parliament, despite the fact that I'm a member of any other member, which means I must move on. The first thing is it's a compulsory scheme that will have to get to be take into account the choice that has been given to mothers over a period of time. So issue of constitutionality may arise in terms of taking the right of choice, etc. Now, in terms of the spirits of mercy, the Act requires the Chief Justice Court to give input to the RC. And the Chief Justice, through the Mercy Commission, has established what we call the Lower Court Remissions Commission. And the Lower Court Remissions Commission, together with Rwanda, have made a request, a demand, that their salaries must be benchmarked against the salary of the Chief Justice, so that there's a process that looks into what is the salary gap. How do you narrow the gap between the salary of the salary indicated of a Chief Justice and the NC level of a magistrate? Those benchmarks are only requested by them, but it's not a system of our law that they have to be benchmarked. The IRC apply its own decision, make its own investigation, and advise the President on how the salary should be structured, etc. And it is not a policy of the IRC to benchmark the salary of a member of parliament against that of a speaker, to benchmark the salary of a traditional leader to that of a king, whatever, etc. They have not adopted policy. But surely, if they want to make a case, I think the IRC is a better place to make a policy choice in terms of what can the president. But as of now, they have been aligning what the Act says. The Act says, in doing the recommendation, they must look across one, the position of finances across the all sectors, and also must take into account the other occupational classes, class whatever, in benchmarking salary situation. Now, I also thought that we must explain briefly the salaries of judges, because they are one, they request that they must be aligned to judges. How do judges' salary scheme work? Firstly, judges do not contribute to a pension fund because they get a continuous salary. Upon serving 15 years, the judge will continue to get salary for life. Upon the death of a judge, the spouse gets 2/3 of the salary. Now, Marte said that dispensation should be similar to that of judges, etc. That dispensation only applies to president. But it's a policy choice that may have to be considered by those who are entrusted with the power to make policy, etc. Take into account the fiscal resources of the state, whether do we want or the state can afford to take 2026 magistrates into a continuous remuneration. Secondly, a judge who is less than 15 years of service receives a continuous salary. You can be a judge for 2 years and go on retirement. You'll get a salary for life. All it means is that you get a percentage of your remuneration. If you serve less than 15 years, you'll get a slight less percentage. If you serve 15 years, you'll get 20%. If you serve 20 years, you get 100%. So if you serve 5 years, you'll get 40%. But it's a scheme of our law that they have a continuous salary. But it comes to condition. One, you cannot take any other remuneration post or whatever unless you get the permission of the minister. And two, you retain the title for judge for life because government pays it for life. Magistrates retains the judge of mercy until they retire. If you retire, you can be a lawyer, you can be an advocate, you can go and be a teacher, whatever. there are no restrictions. And those are the things questions will arise. If you change your policy, do you want masters to have the same dispensation? Do you want the masters for life? Who will remain with the road ever? And those are hard policy choices that government really needs to look into and respond to those other aspects. I have talked about the issue of medical aid, of compulsory permit, etc. But for us, for masters to be included in the permit, there needs to be an amendment to the act and include them, etc. As I said, it will take off some of the rights they've had. And that's the right to choose the medical aid of their choice. Yes. Now, there have been a few consultations in terms of the processes, whatever, etc. And a few things which have been updated to in terms of those consultations. I think they've been expressed that whatever needs to be looked into in terms of policy must look into a broader resource situation of the country, whether is there an aspect that government can afford, broadly taking into account all the pressures that face on government itself. And that will always continue to be a process. And members will also realize that at some other point, this matter was also taken to the court, and the Constitutional Court ruled on that matter. And basically, the court ruled that the president has the powers given to him by act to determine the salaries, and that the IRC can only recommend to the president, but the president who has the power to determine to come with a final decision is the president. And there is nothing wrong to it in terms of that decision. Now, there are two processes that we wanted to allude to into. One, many states have been moved from the public service, which means their salaries are as a result of the recommendation of the IRC. Now, into June 2007-2008 financial year, the IRC came with a comprehensive regime, which made a substantial improvement on the status, not only of Muslims, of all the public officers. Now, the question we take is, now the Commission has also asked for funding to consider another major review following that of 2007. And it is only through the major review that salaries across the different categories of public officers that can be relooked and be reviewed and be adjusted accordingly. Other than that, every year the IRC issue an inflation linked increase because it is not feasible and it's not also viable to have a review every year. And that happens across all the sectors. You have one review over time, but over between those periods you only have an inflation increase to make sure that you take into account the living standards of members who get paid who get funds from the national fiscal. I wanted to come to the recommendations that we see in terms of this process. One, obviously, under the fact that changing the pension benefits dispensation or the medical dispensation of mothers will require parliament involvement. The parliament must change the law as it exists. And you also say that before parliament changes the law, there need to be reform that must take place to indicate what is the flaws of the current policy framework, etc. Two, and what are the resources on the table to take care of whatever changes may be brought into the process. And that change is a matter that should involve not only justice, because there are resource implications, it must also involve national treasure. Because it has the president's involvement, it must also involve the independent commission for the remission of public office bearer. And we've taken the position that it will be better to take that process together with the major review process of the IRC, so that all the involved stakeholders from part of the process. It will not help for government or for the presidency or for national treasury to look into this matter with the execution of the other. And that report, whatever, is that which can justify, which can give a sense whether there's any justification for parliament to change the law, and whether there's any resources that will make sure that the new proposed changes by parliament will be given effect to. The following points are very important for the committee to note. One, the process by which parliament must approve the increase or even the size of justice magistrates is only unique to judicial officers. And by the time that the notice of the president comes to parliament to check whether the parliament approves or disapproves the notice, all other categories of public hospitals have got their increases. Their money are in their pocket. So Parliament comes to determine those increases because, one, as I said, it is a scheme of our constitution. The Parliament must approve them in line with the separation of powers. Now we have to do it. It is important that the timing of that process must get into account, because usually that when the increases come into effect by April, May, June, in respect of every person, Parliament only receives the notice by November, December, and sometimes like last year, Parliament adjourns before they even consider the notices, which means that the increases of masses and charges get delayed, and they only got implemented when the other processes need to get started. So all those things need to be considered in terms of putting in place a process that should address those challenges, that magistrates and judges should not be the last to be considered. And I think those are matters that Parliament and RC and government must look into how they improve on the process. Secondly, while female children is often used as a means to achieving part between the realms of justice and magistrate, it is important that the RC in some instances must take into account the need to have a balance and proportionality between all the stakeholders in the justice environment. And I want to state one point. It was the RC's decision that magistrates should not be remunerated of labor. Now today, a magistrate who gets appointed today gets the same salary as a magistrate who has been in the system for 25 years, because they all get the same salary. In the past, they were levels. So a magistrate started at 5. After 3 years, they get to another level, to another level, or another level, etc. Today, they are not ranks. They are not levels. You get one salary, it's a flat structure. And there's a matter that needs to be understood. Now, the prosecutors, why they earn more than magistrates in certain instances? They have got ranks. Now, you've got a sinner, they've got legs. So you get appointed as a senior prosecutor at a particular range. After 3 years, you get assessed, you get a notch increment. After 3 years, you get a notch increment. After this, then you find that a chief prosecutor have moved above a magistrate because of the notches. Magistrates don't have notches, they stay at the same level until they get an inflation-linked increase, and then, or until the major review, etc. So they mustn't understand that in the case, because prosecutors and public servants are not, the authorities are based on notches, nothing are not. So there are only discrepancies and can only be addressed by the RC through a review. And when the review comes, they get a substantial increase which basically counter those ranks in the prosecution. So it's a two dispensation process that must be looked into. And must be understood at that level. Secondly, and it is for that reason that the major review is necessary, and I think the minister will talk to that matter, that he met with the independent commission for the Revision of Public Hospitals. They've made some requests for funding for them to have a major review, etc. After Parliament have also approved of a bill that allows even Chapter 9 institutions to be considered in the very same way, etc. So that they need to look at this aspect, etc. The other point that is considered is that the tools of trade. Tools of trade are not remuneration. It's what government puts at the disposal of masters and judges to be able to do their work, etc. And those are that continue to be considered in terms of making sure that the car allowances, the motor vehicle for government, SMTs, whatever, are commensurate with our responsibility and expectation in terms of moving forward. And also it's important to consider all this in the context of the financial situation, as was announced by the Minister of Finance recently, especially in respect of those who draw their income from the public sector. This basically indicates the progress where we are, but as I said, those are matters under consideration, and the major review that the RC will undertake will affect most of the concerns. And when we spoke to the RC, they indicated that in the terms of reference for the major review, they'll basically consult with us so that we can see whether there are aspects that pertains to what I said around pensions, etc., which can be added into those terms of reference so that we can all be guided by the outcome. And Parliament can also get the benefit of that, whether is there any need to amend the legislation in terms of what it relates to the pension fund and the medical aid. That's beside the overview of where we are. Thank you, Chair, and thanks, Minister.
Thank you very much. Minister, do you want to... Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think in his usual style, JB has provided more detail than most would have in providing background to this matter, and thanks for that. As you correctly say, the issue of the overall review of the overarching framework for the compensation of public office bearers dates back to, well, the last one that was done was back, I think it was initiated in 2006, those who were in Parliament would recall, and it was quite a challenging navigation process for all of us, because all of us were affected. And it continued for some time after its conclusion to be the talk of the nation. We certainly are looking at a situation where that kind of exercise is imminent at some point. And obviously, in that context, magistrates would then have to be dealt with, also in the context of this notion, super-acting notion of creating a single judiciary, which is where most of the demands are coming from, to say, if you're talking of a notion of a single judiciary, why still have differentiated arrangements for the lower judiciary as opposed to the higher judiciary? The issue is not necessarily just about figures. It's also about structure. How do you, for example, deal with other benefits other than salaries when it comes to magistrates, as if the old dispensation where they were still treated as public servants still pertains? So those are the debates. But in that, we also have to consider the reality that once you've acquired a particular, interest, you may prefer to maintain the status quo if, in your view, you are better off. But often it also depends on how far down are you in the system. So those that have been in the system longer might find a shift to anywhere else, creating one, uncertainty, but two, creating the risk of losing benefits rather than gaining benefits. So you may find a split within the profession, and that's my understanding of what actually prevails currently, is that there isn't necessarily unanimity within the profession, and JB and the other officials who were our lead negotiator on these things would be better placed to clarify and confirm this. But the point being that there would be those amongst magistrates who feel that, like many MPs, I've heard many of us saying, Parliament is too expensive relative to the benefits that you get. It doesn't even cover your gym and other things which Discovery and other medical aid provide. And some even seeking to resist and challenge the legality and constitutionality of us being compelled as public office bearers to subscribe to a specific scheme and not have choice. so those to also just touch on magistrate salaries versus prosecutors. I've served in the Magistrate Commission for the last 5 years, and I can assure you the magistrate's profession has remained highly attractive to prosecutors, to the extent that I am not convinced that even taking a salary dip in some instances for prosecutors to enter the magistracy profession, it has served as a deterrent, if you like, or disincentive for them to avail themselves to the bench. We certainly made huge numbers of appointments from the prosecutorial profession. So I'm not particularly worried about that issue. Certainly, prosecutors are also at the coalface. They are under a lot of pressure to produce convictions. And their performance is critical to the outcome. So we cannot simply underestimate the value they add in the value chain. But certainly we have to be able to say that the principle of a single judiciary does necessitate a reflection that should produce some shift. It might not necessarily be immediately in terms of figures, but certainly in terms of structures and arrangements, so that the principle is reflected in the way in which they are dealt with. But this matter ultimately would have to be negotiated, because we cannot escape the reality of vested interests. People might feel that, yes, there's a principle there, but we have interests here. And trying to reconcile that might not be any easy, but we have to maintain the sensitivity, because it's people's lives that we're dealing with. I think I'll leave it at that and hope we are in the process. I think the appointment of a new judge, I think the term is coming to an end, so there is work that's being done in the presidency around the issue of succession in terms of the leadership of that remuneration commission as well, and I just mentioned in passing. But I think JB has more than I could articulated the issues, and if there are any specific issues colleagues want to raise, we are more than happy to respond to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Minister. Honourable Members, can you clarify questions? That's your time. Thank you. Honourable Member? Yes. Noted.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Honourable Chairperson, I just have two questions. The first one is the effect of these reforms on the budget of the department. The Department of Justice has certain objectives and a certain role that it has to play, and that needs to receive priority. What will the effect of these reforms then be on the department's budget? The second question that I have is, if the Office of the Chief Justice is operational by next year, what will his office's role be that they will play in negotiating these salaries? Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Martinez.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is with regards to the issue of department. I hear the department are still taking the constitutionality of moving the magistrate to permit. also what the minister has raised with regards to some resistance and also the challenges that you're confronted with permits. Want to find out whether the department has also explore or check the issue with regards to the proportion allocation, the contribution. Now is before Mosenike Commission, it used to be two-thirds contribution by department, by government. Now Mosenike Commission reversed it, reviewed to be one-third. That's the reason why the contribution from members of the department is more than the others. So people who used to be here told us that their contribution used to be less than this. So I just want to check whether the departments have taken those into consideration. Have they checked the report of the commission of Mosenike to Peruzzo to be able to assist them in regards to the preparation? And now because of the DOR is going to make a comprehensive review of remuneration of the public office bearers, including that. That's one to say, then can you also to be able to assist yourself, be able to prepare, better prepared. The other issue that puzzled and worried at the same time, the HOD of DOG, and then also the I didn't get your name at the time that you were presented. Through you, Chair, if I can, because I want to address him.
It's Kosana.
Okay. That is Kosana presented, and now the minister. With regards to, because of the, that is Kosana was confirming what the HOD presented to us of the DOJ with regards to implication of OSD in the magistrates. Because they say there's a challenge with them. In fact, Rizikas said, because the OSD has placed prosecutors to the certain level, now some of them are any more than magistrates. So those are the challenges that they are being confronted with. Now the minister says, no, he's not worried or protected with regards to issue of the magistrates and the prosecutors who are any more, so that we will know in future that there will be shortage of magistrates, people want to move them and go to the bench. So if then the minister be able to assist us or myself to be able to say that is it really not affecting, the OSD issue is not really affecting the department, because of we in our minister they have adopted, we said the DOJ must consult the Department of DPSA with regards to the OSD and also raise the challenges that they are confronted, because it also has budgetary constraints with the department. So there are implications that they are there. And also be able to, I'm also raising this, as the department also consult with the DPSA, because also the DPSA are on the process of the bargaining issues. There might be also kind of review of their salaries, so that their work must not be cumbersome. After reviewing, total review of the magistrate, now the DPSA's also packages also be able to affect them. So in the long run, should be able not to be able to affect their work to really help to cover some.
Thank you.
The input that is being deprived of us as a community will be as much as with some of the inputs I compare to the JP. But there's an issue, Minister, here that when I'm debating within myself, JBL becomes very, very, very emotional. For instance, before the dispensation of democracy, there were issues that we see it, they need to be repaired. For instance, I'm very, very frustrated about the Magistrate Act of 1944. Because some minister issues want to compare the current situation and the old order. That is the conflict which is off without more analysis in it. Then those things of the apartheid and the current situation, they confuse us to get to the decision. That's why that I'm saying this input at some stage become confusing me in my instinct in terms of thinking what is the way forward. For instance, to me, if I can have a platform to discuss in the new dispensation in terms of the economy of our country and the globalization, how can we have a certain percentage that can be paid to a person not having an input in the economy of the country? To me, it's a political question. If a person, for instance, to me, the both JB, both prosecutor, both magistrate, they don't give any impact to the economy in terms of monetary instability within the economy of the country. If the new Muslims, I would say, akukho ngeniso izayo enkampanini, there's nothing that the company can say, Tabiso is doing this, then the company is getting this percentage. Those are the issues that they should give us the analysis going forward, tools of analysis and tools of understanding when we are going to the issue of the economy versus the stability of the country. My question now is the Van Rooyen. I'm not against it. And it means that the problem is in the new dispensation, there's no salary. In my understanding, there is a victimization of some sort within the magistrate fraternity. Because the input itself is silent about the experience of a category within the unit of magistrate. Let me can make an example. This person is a magistrate before 1994. What is the current status of that magistrate in the current context? That's my question. Look at the issue of the prosecutor. It's better with the prosecutors because if I would have whatever input to convert the magistrate fraternity to the lodges, and if it's need be, make a better package in the entry point of the land within the salary package. Let's assume the entry point plus minus is 5. You say at notch 15 or 15 top, between 14 and 15 grade, that will be according to the experience, percentage to the experience, so that there's no big parity between the structures, but the concept is one, is to justify the justice, and justice should be independent, because there's nothing. That means when you are independent, you must be portrayed as a magistrate, as the person that is different from the prosecutor. That's my discussion. Because the concept is one. The content of doing the division is almost one. Maybe it's different is a thin line. So when you analyze the matrix and the methodology, you separate program going forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable. Thank you very much. Honorable.
Thanks, Chairperson, and thanks for the briefing by the department. And I think we now honor to our Honorable Minister for coming and bring up the presentation with the political context. Chair, I think we must accept that the issue at hand is a bit complex. It is not, you know, as one might see them think and take a decision here and now and say, no, give them this increment, tell the commissioner to run them this way and not that way. It's a complex in this way, Chair. The current scenario explained to us, it says magistrates are falling into two categories. One, they are regarded as public office bearers. Two, they are regarded as civil servants. You know, either way, for some other benefits that are in this side, for the other benefits they are in the other side, you know. Therefore, for us, we must acknowledge that the matter will need a thorough, you know, open platform discussion that might not even be the value of the department alone. It requires some serious, you know, political decisions to say where do we put and categorize the issues of magistrate. Look, there are streamlining coming from the judiciary category of the state as an organ of state. But in the you know, flowing down, they become diverted and then become, you know, one way or another cross towards, you know, the civil servant part of a category. Therefore, in itself, it then brings some level of compromising the independency of, you know, the three spheres of organ, because they are flowing from Chief Justice coming down. But when they are supposed to conclude the era they are flowing, they are crossing to, you know, the other category of saying now their benefits are falling into the GEMS category. GEMS category is a government employment, you know, medical aid on itself. Then it tells you that it is for a specific right. The reason I'm saying this matter is very complex, Chair. I'm from the ranks of one institution that is falling into the same, you know, trend, which is the institution of traditional leadership. It comes from on top, categorized as a public office bearer. But when they come into their benefits does not get considered in that particular category. They, you know, switch and become, you know, part of this other area. I would add that what we need to do from the ranks of ourselves, Honorable Minister, is to take this department and put it in a higher level gear to say we need to take this. Because when the magistrates are demanding, putting facts that they're putting on the ground, nobody can say you are out of order. But when you are to say, let's implement it, there are a lot of, you know, implications that range from the laws themselves that we are having, the legislations that govern the you know, the remuneration itself, including the laws that govern the medical part and the pension part, which is the core focus of the area of concern. When they explain the demand from the presentation, surely nobody can stand and say you are talking nonsense. They are talking sense. But how do you then make the sense to become, you know, evolve within our own understanding how do we want to operate? It is another issue. Because we need to check whether the fiscal of this country will got the capacity to sustain what we then agree on. On the same footing, we are always saying it should not reach a level where this category, as we are continuing to locate a way in which we can evolve it into its logical conclusion, into the era of ourselves, and find a space as to how do we best, you know, manage and administer this particular organ of state, which is, it is a bit, you know, dicey. It falls either way. When they wanted to put their case, at one stage it will become purely a civil servant institution. When they are at a particular level, they become purely, public office bearer. So, to me, it's a matter that required a mammoth task. Maybe the department, together with Parliament, must then arrive at, let's give a time frame to say, this matter require an intensive investigations and proper regulatory framework, which would then be considered by Parliament. I know if you said a year to two, they themselves might say no. You will set two because you are comfortable. We are not comfortable. You know, when you are comfortable, you don't have reasons why you have to turn into the other side of your list. Because this other side of your list, you feel flattered, you are at the wealth of enjoying yourself. They are not enjoying their, sitting on something that is, through their lips, and they wanted to have see changes very soon. But I guess what we need to do is to lobby them to understand that we understand this thing. But it cannot be a decision taken overnight. It requires a holistic approach and see to it that the decision we are taking, it will be the decision that will take, it will take us, for quite some time. That's my input here. We cannot, the importance of this presentation is continue to give us, an overview to say we need to give this thing sufficient time and an effort, maybe task a team to deal with it over a particular period. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Yes, Chief Whip.
Thank you, Chair. No, in the first I also, Chair, thank the presenter and the minister, Chair, for the information given. Is the predecessor committee, Chair, sees to in this matter issues of aspects that relate to what the department itself, given the situation we are in and the enormity of the work that requires to be undertaken, was based on the fact that there are things that the department would do. I recall the presentation that they did in the predecessor committee, which was talking to what they just to close the gap itself. I'm not sure whether that part. So my inquiry is whether that part of those things that right away from the department in those aspects that they needed to, that they could do in trying to deal with the gaps that could be done, whether those are now completed besides notwithstanding the reforms that they are mooted, Chair, here. The second part, Chair, is the issue which I think we will be seized with and the predecessor committees seized with, is the issue of then the final decision which was put to court, and the court has pronounced on quite a number of those aspects, Chair. And it was overturned, I think, on appeal, if I recall correct, in terms of what was being challenged by the magistrate to court, which relates to then the final decision on what do you then give to magistrate? Whether, I mean, from the recommendations of the RC and the decision of the president, and that always remain, and several times the in particular the committee of the NCOP, the select committee, at some point didn't approve what was proposed for the magistrate after interacting and applying his mind. So I'm saying, Chief, it's not a matter that would still not come. I think it depends on what would be the final determination from the president or by the president, which will then bring us back to the same matters, Chair. Therefore, I think, Chair, for the presentation, as a committee, we would, I think, Chair, say that we do need further, engagements, and it that also relating to the issues of the matters that are raised or contained in the judgment, because I think there is useful information in that judgment, which starts to talk to some of these aspects. And then secondly, also to see what the department itself is doing, because it should not be seen as if it's not our work. It's the work of the RC, and yet they are a critical component of the mandate of the department. Such whether you've arrived at a single judiciary or not yet, but as we speak, they are still, even that independence and single judiciary is an interest of the department itself. I think it's important to note those aspects, but going forward, that the aspects that are contained in the judgment, I guess the content advisor is also listening for the committee, for ourselves to bring those matters back to the committee, look at them, and then the department chair to the, because that presentation was talking to what progress that presentation was saying progressively they are dealing with the matters of closing the gaps. I think JB will remember that presentation, and I think we would like to see have they completed that road of progressively making sure that some of the things are corrected as we go along. They were showing, that presentation was even showing how much have the magistrate moved from where they were to where they are at that time. So perhaps it can still show us where they are now, having moved from that level. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Over to you, Department. Can you? Thank you.
Yeah, I'll leave the technical issues to the department to respond to. They might not themselves have all the answers to all the questions. I'm not sure if anybody can claim to have all the answers to all the questions, for obvious reasons which colleagues themselves have articulated. the issue about closing the gap has always been the subject of, if you like, heated debate across the spectrum. We here in Parliament, you would recall, had our own bit to say at the time when the percentage increases with a major retraction was happening between the different levels within Parliament itself, between Parliament and the executive, to the judiciary at different levels. There were those debates internally within the judiciary itself, in the sense of the lower court versus the high court, the judiciary versus the public representative. So it goes vertical, horizontal, it comes backwards and forwards. It's just the nature of this game. It's not like a game of soccer where after 90 minutes you can say the score is settled. It's never settled. So we will continue to be pleased with this matter, I suspect, for as long as we continue to breathe. there's also this thing about rights versus interest. I think to some extent our law, labor law, somewhat settled the issue to say that labor relations law is about creating a legal framework within which competing interests can contest in a structured, I wouldn't use the word civil because I don't want to come across as being judgmental about particular actions where the temperatures go high and so on. But in a legally organized and structured way. But to say there are certain things which become isolated out as matters of right, which then get regulated by law and which are beyond negotiation. That was one way of bringing some kind of structure in the labor relations. For example, the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. Boom, 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 you have specific rights, the employer must simply comply, they don't comply, you don't negotiate it, it's illegal, you go to the CMA and you get your award. Whereas salary increases, annual salary increase will always be issues of interest, and there will be all sorts of juggling between the competing interest groups. So why am I even mentioning that? To begin to say that one thing we will never resolve in a process like this would be issues of interest, because they will never be constant. They are never static. And they don't have an end. They are perpetual in nature. They resuscitate all the time. So, and that's why there are structures created for that. So to note. But in this context, the complexity really is, as we begin to revisit the framework, issues of right and issues of interest get into a Maccabee dance, the Maccabee dance of death again, because here we are talking of principle that says single judiciary, promote independence of the judiciary, therefore let's have a single framework for all, irrespective of whether they are lower or higher, regardless of the quantum, regardless of the amount involved, but a single framework. Now, on the face of it, it looks like that is the perfect way to go if you follow the constitutional principle of a single judiciary. But then interest comes in and says, but if you go that route, not everybody gains out of it. There will be others who feel differently in terms of how it's going to affect their interests. So, do you impose this on them and say, principle is principle, one size fits all, or what do you do? Bearing in mind that people's interests cannot simply be ignored. They can be very real. Because if I become insolvent because of the new rules that have created new financial obligations on me, which I am now beginning to adapt to, you won't be there when I'm getting sequestrated and I lose my job as a magistrate because I can't afford it anymore. And that's why one of the rules in labor law, as I understand it, is that generally when you shift people around, you don't affect their salaries and benefits negatively. Because you don't want people to make one step forward in their economic circumstances and two steps backward in life generally, as a rule of thumb. So
those are some of the realities that we can't simply ignore. Now, quickly through a few points that I wanted to touch on. Certainly, this is a process that involves different levels of decision making. There's the RC that must recommend to the president, the president who must, as head of the policy authority at national level under the constitution, who must then, make a determination. And then there is the parliament, which as part of its lawmaking authority has the authority to make a final say. But obviously, acting with the level of sensitivity, responsibility, accountability, etc., which is given, I don't need to mention that. So we are in it together. Now, the issue of the independence which was raised, and pardon me for not following things in the order that they were asked, a colleague here in front of me, diagonal to me, who just walked up, raised the issue about the fact that both prosecutorial and ministerial professions should be treated under the Constitution as independent, and if so, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, to paraphrase the thinking there. And to what extent is this differentiated salary benefits compromise the one as pitched against the other on this score? I just wanted to mention, as I said earlier, having served on the Magistrates Commission for some time, that indeed we ask this question to a lot of prosecutors who apply for position of magistracy. What is your incentive to want to become a magistrate when at this point in time you are at a notch in the prosecutorial profession that puts you at a greater advantage with the prospect of promotion over time, which is not necessarily guaranteed if you become a magistrate, because you're likely to start there and spend some years. And the way it works is that the number of years that you have served as a magistrate does not automatically guarantee you promotion. The Magistrate Commission receives applications, shortlists, decide on a range of criteria, who gets appointed as a magistrate, who gets promoted as a senior magistrate, and you might be there for 20 years as a magistrate and not be so lucky, whereas somebody else after 5 years or 7 years might find themselves going up the ranks, or even lifted out of the magistracy profession and find themselves as a judge elsewhere. And talking about that as well, you know, the system that we have in South Africa is not one where, and that's where the complication around the perception that you become a magistrate, you become a senior magistrate, and then you go up the ladder as it goes. The system we have in South Africa is not one where even when you become the president of the regional court, which is the highest position in the magistracy, guarantees you that the next step is automatically to become a judge, let alone a senior position in the judiciary. You could become the president of the magistrate's court, and that might just be where you end. It really depends on how processes at the JSC go. But the other factor there is that the work in the lower courts and the nature of matters and the level of intensity, sort of putting it in a better way, is not necessarily the same as in the high courts. can't just assume that somebody who's been a magistrate for many years stands a better chance of appointment as a judge compared to somebody who's been practicing in the bar as an advocate, or for that matter has been practicing doing a lot of high court work as an attorney. That person might get appointed as a judge, and you as a judge president or a chief magistrate find yourself still lingering in the magistrate. Well, others might actually not even want to become judges anyway and feel comfortable. So there are all those complexes. So the assumption around progression, career progression between the higher courts and the lower courts does not necessarily always pertain. Certainly, I've seen at some point strong advocacy for appointments to the bench from among the ranks of magistrates, but nothing is guaranteed in the system. Excuse me. The issue about notches in the magistrate, as far as I know, there are no notches anywhere in public office bearer positions. There was a push back in 2006, for example, here in Parliament, that the longer you have been here, your years of service should be acknowledged by way of a notch system as an MP. And that was eventually rejected. There's no notches in the judiciary as far as I'm aware. You're a judge, you're a judge, you're a judge. Unless you're a judge president, then that's where a notch comes in, which is not really a notch. But that's the salary for that position, and that's it. You get that until you die, except in the case of restructuring or in the, of the salary and benefits, or in the case of annual increase. So that system of notches just doesn't apply to public office bearers as far as I'm aware. It applies in relation to employees, not office bearers. Now, prosecutors, as far as I understand, they are actually employees. They sign an employment contract. The only people in the NPA who are office bearers, if they are, if I need to be clarified, would be the top echelon of a group like the NDPP and the deputies, because they are established, their role is defined in the constitution and the law. So the issue of notch simply wouldn't apply anyway. Otherwise, it would be to fudge the whole concept. You can talk about salary levels, but you can't really talk about differentiated arrangements. So I can just hint, for example, that there was a judgment around acting magistrates where the court said, you are a magistrate, you are a magistrate, you are a magistrate, to paraphrase. So even if you are an acting appointment, you automatically enjoy the same status and salary level as a permanent magistrate, because you're a magistrate. And there are issues around that, because acting appointment can be for a day, can be for a month, and so on. So how do you deal with issues of benefit under those circumstances? But that's a debate for another day. The issue of the economic contribution, one of the entire legal profession, judicial system, civil or criminal, or for that matter of any other profession, can always be a subject of debate. I'm not an economist, so I'll not pretend I am, or a political economist either. But what I can say is that there is no economy in the world, I believe, that can function without a functional judicial system.
transport based in law. You give me a car, I pay you. You give me a car, I don't pay you. What do you do? You have to go to court and enforce it, or else you must come with a 3-pound hammer and bash my head so that you get your money. There's two ways, you see. So there's no economy that really can function. And suppose you bash my head, is it a justified way of enforcing your claim against me? If it's not, what happens then? That's where your criminal law comes. Somebody must come to my rescue and protect my head from being bashed. That's where the criminal law. So you can't separate this.
I don't think our case would be the manner that the reply was released, because when more especially the issues that I was highlighting, I didn't even say any of the little of discussion. I didn't say whatever I was in. I was just inputting to highlight the problem that is in the stage in front of the committee. And I was not having a cut and dry issue, say they must go for this, they must go. It was just putting in front of us that we discuss and come with an alternative, even if of the lack of the motion. I know that people in the judiciary are judicial gurus, but the problem now is in front of us all.
I apologize. That was not the intention.
So if my input can be analyzed as he is doing it, I'm very disappointed.
No, no, no.
That's why I say order.
No.
Okay.
No, colleague. It was not intended in that manner. I was simply speaking in jest, really. I was speaking on a light note.
Thank you.
I certainly respect the input on this issue. I think it's a critical issue. I may have dealt with it in a light manner, but the intention was not to underestimate the importance of the point, because the point is very relevant. I was simply trying in a very simplistic way to show the difficulty that you will always have in trying to resolve that particular question. So colleague, please don't take offense. It was maybe I came across as a little bit insensitive, but the idea really was to really speak in a light mode, not to in any way underestimate the importance of the issue itself. I think it's an important issue. I think I must just clarify that, and my apologies if it came across that way. But on the issue of the OSD, I do not have full information as to what the specifics were, and I'll leave it to the colleagues in the department to deal with that. The issue of the role of the Office of the Chief Justice in the negotiation process, I doubt if it's likely to feature. Look, the Chief Justice is now firmly as the Chief Justice established as the head of the judiciary, and naturally matters relating or affecting the judiciary across the board should have his involvement or its involvement as in the institution of the Chief Justice. But I think we should also, when we talk of the Office of the Chief Justice, distinguish between two things. There is a person who is a judge who is called a Chief Justice, who heads the judiciary. But there's also an administrative entity in the form of a government department, more or less, that has been established and was given a name called the Office of the Chief Justice. It does not consist of the Chief Justice himself,
actually headed by an accounting officer at the level of a DG, who is called a Secretary General. So that office only deals with administrative issues, nothing to do with policy and judicial function. It's simply there to give administrative support to the judiciary to perform judicial functions. So clearly they cannot be involved. But as far as the Chief Justice himself as the head of the judiciary, any matter that affects members of the judiciary should. And then one or two last points. Issues of implications for the budget, which Koshi also, when he said that there is going to have to be a balancing that takes into consideration the implication of this at a practical level. Certainly, budgetary issues are going to affect that, even if we adopt a principled approach in promoting a single judiciary, financial implications might necessitate that at least there is a phasing in process that is developed so that nothing is done as a big bang, because we all had the Minister of Finance during his medium-term budget speech that we have to tighten our belts. So a lot of things that could have been possible a few years ago at this point in time in the economic situation that we're in are realities that we cannot ignore. I think, Chair, I'll leave it to officials if they want to add to any of the issues that were asked. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister. Because of time, I think, may I ask, is there any questions are not answered, honourable members? Do you need more? No, I think it's fine, because we need to proceed to another, to item number 6. I think members are happy. Can we just get a briefing by Legal Aid South Africa on the Legal Aid South Africa Bill? Bill 18-2014. Even then, I think, because there is another committee need to come to get in. Thank you. Brief. 5 minutes if we can make it. Sorry. Okay, thank you very much.
Chair, thank you very much. I realize the time constraints. A briefing document was submitted to all committee members. I understand that committee members have received it. It's quite detailed. So I'm going to ask my colleague, Ms. Wilma Lowe, sitting behind me, to take you through it, but possibly just to highlight the key aspects and not to go through that briefing document in detail, because all the details are there for members to see. We also circulated for the benefit of honourable members a copy of the Legal Aid Act, the 1969 Act, which this bill intends to replace, in case members want to refer to it and see what the existing situation is about. What I could also just mention is, in brief, this bill is really about creating a new structure. It's about governance, not so much about legal issues. The Act is a 1969 one. It's outdated. It requires revision. And this bill is to be considered, I understand, by the National Assembly tomorrow in its second reading debate. And I'm going to ask Ms. Lowe to continue and just to highlight the key aspects of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson and honourable members. Clause 1 provides for definitions. These are self-explanatory. Clause 2 provides for the establishment of Legal Aid South Africa as a national public entity, and it will be governed by a board of directors. The objects of Legal Aid South Africa are set out in Clause 3. It is mainly to render or make available legal aid or legal advice and provide legal representation to persons at state expense. And the new object is to provide education and information concerning rights and obligations. Clause 4 provides for powers and functions of the board. This is quite run-of-the-mill type of powers and functions. They can also employ legal practitioners, candidate attorneys, paralegals, or procure private practitioners' service. Clause 5 provides that Legal Aid South Africa and its directors, employees, and agents must serve impartially and independently. And this is a new provision. Clause 6 provides for the composition of the board. Currently there are 18 members. The new board will consist of 14 members. A judge, 8 members who have certain skills, the CEO of Legal Aid South Africa, and then 3 senior executive persons from Legal Aid South Africa as the Director General of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. Clause 7 provides for the qualifications. These are also quite standard, fit and proper South African citizens, not insolvent, etc. And the equity must be taken into account when the board members are elected. Clause 7 provides for chairperson and deputy chairperson. The judge is the chairperson and the minister will designate one of the directors as deputy. Clause 9 provides for term of appointment, and the directors will serve between 3 and 5 years. They can be reappointed once. Clause 10 provides for termination of membership. A director ceases to be a director when he resigns, becomes disqualified, or leaves the employee of Legal Aid South Africa. And the minister may also remove a director in certain instances. Clause 11 provides for meetings of the board. They must meet at least 4 times per year, and there can be special meetings. Clause 12 is quorum. The quorum is half of the board's members plus 1. Clause 13 provides for committees. This is a new provision, and this is necessary for the functioning of the board. And clause 14 provides for delegations of powers, and this is also subject to the Public Finance Management Act. Clause 15 is provides for a new arrangement, namely the appointment of a CEO. And the board appoints a CEO for a maximum of 5 years, which is renewable. Clause 16 provides for functions of the CEO, and this person is responsible for the general administration of Legal Aid South Africa. Clause 17 is employees. This provision differs from the Act as the board currently appoints the employees, but in future the CEO will do this. Clause 18, terms and conditions of employment, and Legal Aid South Africa's employees and the CEO are employed subject to conditions and remuneration as determined by the board in consultation with the minister and the Minister of Finance. Clause 19 relates to client privilege. There is no similar provision in the Act, and a private legal practitioner must, when requested by Legal Aid South Africa, grant access to the information contained in the client's file. And this is for purposes of quality control. Clause 20, recovery of costs. This is the instance where there's a civil case which the Legal Aid client wins, and the court directs that the other party must pay its costs. Then Legal Aid South Africa can get that cost because initially they paid it. Clause 21 relates to finance. Legal Aid South Africa gets money from Parliament or from any other source such as interest. Clause 22, legal aid by direction of court in criminal matters. This is similar to the current position. And this clause describes what the court has to take into consideration and what steps must have been taken before it gives a direction that the person should receive legal aid at state expense. And this decision is reviewable by the High Court. Clause 23 provides that the minister must make certain regulations regarding the type of matters for which legal aid is provided, the requirements an applicant must comply with, this is the so-called means test, and the policy relating to approval, refusal, or termination of legal aid. Clause 24 provides for the legal aid manual. Currently, this is called the Legal Aid Guide, and the board must compile this document and amend and review it at least every second year. And this document will provide for administrative matters and procedures. Clause 25, repeal of laws. Clause 26 provides for transitional provisions. The current board members are deemed to have been appointed under the bill and remain for 12 months of the commencement of the new act. And then the three persons from Legal Aid South Africa as well as its CEO comes in and also becomes members of the transitional board. And then they must facilitate the appointment of a new board within 12 months. And the CEO, the current CEO remains in office after commencement of the bill. And clause 27 provides for a short title and commencement. The act will come into operation on a date fixed by the President. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chair. Members, do you need clarity here or can you do it in writing? I'm worried about time. I think, thank you. Oh, yes, sorry.
Can I make a proposal in the interest of time that perhaps they immediately present the other bill as well? Because although they're different, but they're quite close. And then we can engage on both bills.
Chair, I'm a bit uncertain. I wasn't aware that we're going to deal with the attorney's amendment bill today. If that's on the agenda.
It's not on program day.
I am too much ahead of everybody. My apologies.
Thank you, Minister. Members and Chair, I think members will submit or in writing their clarities if they need so. And I would like to thank the department.
Just to clarify the process, that is that we brought the presentation forward before the bill is formally referred to the NCOP from the NA for the purposes of time. For the purposes of it being presented to us and introduced so that we are then able to go back and read and come back to deliberate on the bill itself. So the process really was for noting the briefing and the presentation. Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honourable Zimande, for that clarity. Let me take this opportunity to say thank you to the department. Thank you to you, Honourable Minister, for coming and brief us, and now we can prepare ourselves now. Thank you very much, sir, for your time. And I think this meeting is just for waiting for the next meeting. Can you just
just want to find out then the briefing with regards to magistrates will be done at the next meeting?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
The meeting is adjourned.